Good afternoon, Mr. Aberley.
Yes, Aberley, yes, sir.
And Mr. Phillips.
Yes, Your Honor.
Welcome to the Fifth Circuit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Dennis, and I can keep from disappearing. Judge Dennis, together with Judge Higginson and Judge Costa, we're your panel for this first case this afternoon, United States of America versus Miguel Alfonso Morris. We'll hear first from Mr. Aberley, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Aberley, close enough. Yes, I am Christopher Aberley, and I'm court-appointed counsel for Mr. Miguel Morris, who in this appeal challenges both his guilty plea and his sentence. The sentence in this case, the issue involves a novel legal question which the court may want to address, but the issue is straightforward, and this court will not need to reach that issue if it agrees that the search, the seizure of the drugs in this case violated the Fourth Amendment. That issue is the more consequential one for Mr. Morris. So unless the court directs otherwise, I will focus my argument on our challenge to the ruling on the motion to suppress. Now, to support the government's contention that the stop and the encounter leading up to the giving of consent was a mere consensual, casual police citizen contact, the government had to clear two hurdles in the district court, and we contend that it stumbled in both cases. The first hurdle is the initial stop. The government argued, and the district court found, and I quote the district court, a reasonable person would have felt free to continue driving. Now, despite the reference to driving, the district court relied for this conclusion on cases that involved police approaching a car that was already parked before the police even interjected themselves in the situation. In other words, in those cases, unlike in this case, the police did not cause the defendant to stop his moving vehicle. That makes this case different because the law regarding moving vehicles is different. Here, Mr. Morris was driving his car, and while he may have been driving slowly and in a parking lot, the officers could not interact with him unless the car stopped, no less so than if he was driving 70 miles an hour on the interstate. So here, Mr. Morris stopped his car only because two uniformed police officers unambiguously signaled him to do so. And we contend there, therefore, under Mendenhall and Delaware v. Prowse, Morris was subject to an automobile stop, just as though if he had been pulled over on the interstate. And just like a stop on the interstate or any traffic stop, it is irrelevant, contrary to what the district court found, that once stopped, the defendant's car was not physically restrained from leaving. In short, the police conducted a Terry stop of Mr. Morris, which could only be justified by reasonable suspicion.
So, counsel, let me ask about, assume for argument's sake that the initial waving down or stopping of the vehicle was a seizure, as you say. So I'm just focused on that initial stop. The reasonable suspicion, I think the government points to the fact that it's a high drug area, that stop where he was parked. Two, he's parked back with the 18-wheelers. And three, he starts driving. His car is never really turned off, and then he starts driving when the officers are approaching. Talk to me about whether those three things give rise to reasonable suspicion. And I don't know if you're familiar with our Flowers case from a few months ago, where there's a car parked outside a convenience store. I mean, to me, this seems like more suspicious grounds that the government's asserted than you had in Flowers, where the car was just really parked briefly outside a convenience store. So if you can address that.
Sure. In Flowers, which was a split decision, the court held that the parked car was, the district court found that the parked car was parked in a way that the two men in it did not appear to be patronizing the establishment. That's a factor you wouldn't have here because, you know, resting in a rest stop is you know, there's no establishment. Second, the court in Flowers said that the car was parked in a manner, let me quote them, was parked in a manner that suggested to the seasoned officer that its occupants might be casing the store or preparing to prey on its patrons. As indicated by the fact that there was a dissent in that case, the situation there, we contend with, sort of sits on the line of what constitutes reasonable suspicion based on where and how a car is parked. We think Mr. Morris's case plainly does not come as close to the line as it did in Flowers. Morris was alone. Nothing about the manner in which the car was parked suggested any impending criminality. And notably in Flowers, there was this court distinguished a contrary holding in U.S. v. Hill from 2014 on several grounds. And one of the grounds was, and I quote, in Hill, the car was parked, quote, in a location where one would expect multiple cars to be parked, not in a suspicious spot as the only car in a convenience store lot. So we think that distinguishes Flowers.
But he is unusual in that there's a car parked back with the 18-wheelers. And I think maybe the innocent explanation for that would be, well, like those truck drivers, someone driving a car wants to take a nap as well, and it's darker back there as opposed to the regular parking lot. But then isn't that dispelled by the fact that he's never really sleeping there because his car's on and then he starts moving as soon as the officers approach?
Well, first of all, they don't know how long he was there. I mean, whether he had rested already or what. But, you know, if you're free to leave, and then you do so, and then you use that freedom, the exercise of that freedom, to say there's reasonable suspicion, that just doesn't seem to be a good way to approach the analysis.
Remind me procedurally, did the district court have this hearing, or was this in front of the magistrate?
It was in front of the magistrate judge.
And so I know Detective Thorpe expressly stated he didn't have suspicion. Correct. I mean, that was their entire testimony was, we're waving at him. We don't have reasonable suspicion. But did the government then in any closing argument also say, all we had here was a hunch, we were just doing a little waving at? I mean, that's certainly the government's position in his brief to us, that this is a police waving, quote, at a citizen. So it would seem to me the evidence and the government's argument has actually been to negative reasonable suspicion. But tell me if I'm wrong about that.
No, I would agree with that. And not just Officer Thorpe, but the other, there were two deputies initially, and both of them testified that they didn't have any reasonable suspicion that
I suppose it doesn't matter what's in their mind, but if the district court and the magistrate never got to it.
No. They did not get to it. No finding was made in the district court about reasonable suspicion, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah, it's just a little bit of a complication, but I guess we'll hear from the government.
Now, if the car was parked, if parking a car in the rest area of a truck stop is sufficient reason for stopping the car when it starts to drive away, we contend that the government surely stumbled at the next hurdle, which is establishing that the continued encounter remained purely consensual up until the time that Mr. Morris acceded to Corporal Matt's repeated request to search the car, or alternatively, that any reasonable suspicion justifying the initial stop had not dispelled by that time.
Well, the second encounter you focus on is captured by a video, right? The body cam shows how they asked him to get out of the car.
Yes.
And they said, do you mind? That sounds somewhat permissive.
Right. But you take the totality of the situation in this case. You have the two officers have asked him questions. He's answered them. Then Corporal Matt comes in and asks the same questions and then another 20 questions and then asks him to get out of the car. There's four officers there. They're all uniformed, armed. It's late at night. It's dark. It's in the behind a building. And, you know, Mr. Morris is a Black Hispanic man. And after he's out of the car, Corporal Matt really goes at him and makes it clear, to my mind, it's clear that he was basically telling Mr. Morris, you are not free to leave until you let us search your car. I mean, the language used, and I'm quoting, the more you cooperate, the faster, he says, keep your hands out of your pockets. The faster you cooperate, the faster we'll be done, and I'll let you go about your way. And later, the more you cooperate, the faster we get done. Then, the faster you cooperate, the faster we'll be done with this. And finally, he says, so if you want to go back to sleep, let us, now he was cut off at that point, but it's clear he meant, let us search your car. We think by that time, Mr. Morris could not possibly have felt free to leave. Now, if the search was initially supported by reasonable suspicion, we contend that that was dispelled. After they asked him questions, he answered them satisfactorily. His driver's license came back clean. They searched his car with the flashlights and saw nothing there. I think at that point, they no longer had a reason to continue to detain him. Now, if the government clears both of those hurdles, they still have one more hurdle to go, and that is whether the consent given was consensual, given freely and voluntarily. And we argued that if the court gets to this point, it should find that consent was not given freely and voluntarily. Now, we have argued that the six factors, the district court misapplied the six factors for determining consensual consent. In fact, we argued that not a single one of them supports the government's position here. But if you just focus on two of them, the voluntariness of the situation and the use of coercive police procedures, those by themselves preclude a finding of free and voluntary consent. Specifically, and again, against the backdrop of Mr. Morris asked to step out of his car in the night, in the back, you know, in the dark, surrounded by foreign police officers, with Corporal Matt, by his own concession, wearing down Mr. Morris by repeatedly conveying to him that his ability to be left alone was conditioned on his agreeing to his car being searched. And it's clear from the video that but for that coercive technique, Mr. Morris would not have relented and allowed the officers to enter and search his car. So in other words, it's our position that that is not consent, that it's given freely and voluntarily. Thank you.
Well, before you, yes. I mean, in case if we do get to the sentencing issue,
yes.
Does this case really present the unusual circumstance of no comparators? Because when I noticed how the PSR said no minor role, then there was no objection, then you got an out of time objection. But the out of time objection, your client, I don't know if it was you at press as a counsel, specifically said, here are the comparators. The guy who put it in the car, and I forget what the other fellow did. The guy who put it in the car, and then the guy who was going to be candidate. So in your argument objecting to the PSR, this was not the hypothetical difficult case. This was, here are the two people, and then it would just be, well, did the district court commit clear error saying that Morris isn't substantially less culpable than the two people he's pointing to? So I've been confused as to why it seems like both parties here are trying to say this has to be the difficult hypothetical. Do you remember the record here? And wasn't it the fact that comparators were identified?
Well, certainly, I wasn't counsel, but recalling the reading of the sentencing transcript, counsel very clearly argued that the comparison can be made, and along with all the other factors, you have more than just the guy who put the drugs in the car in one city, because you're somebody was in the originating city.
No, I know, but I guess what I'm asking you is, for the district court to have to dive into a fact dispute about the PSR, there was the objection and it pointed to two people. And I'm not sure you would be arguing now, or are you arguing that Morris is substantially less culpable than the two people that Morris pointed to ask for the reduction?
Well, on appeal, what I'm arguing is that because of the fact finding was never made.
Yes. So you want to get back. You want to get back and have fact finding done.
Correct. We're not standing on that they're definitely that he's entitled to the role, the minor role reduction. We're simply arguing that he was entitled to have that determination made and it wasn't. And that okay. And that in on this record, you can't say that it wouldn't apply because you have, you know, the factors. He exercised no decision-making authority. He was all he did was drive a car. He didn't even know what the drugs were, so he says. He didn't put them there, someone else did, etc.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Have you finished, Mr. Haberty?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Mr. Phillips?
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Forrest Phillips for the United States. This court should affirm the district court in all respects. I want to start with the motion to suppress issue. It's the central issue in this case. The district court did not err in denying that motion to suppress because Mr. Morris's interaction with the deputies was consensual, or in the alternative, reasonable suspicion had developed by the time this became a, you know, Terry v. Ohio applicable seizure.
Mr. Phillips, you're not pressing the position you took in the brief that this was just police, quote, waving at a citizen?
No, Your Honor, I do. And I want to start with that initial encounter and talk about that making contact by flagging down or waving Mr. Morris. I think that when you look at the beginning of this encounter and see how officers made contact with Mr. Morris, all the circumstances are unexceptional in the sense that they fit neatly with a parked car scenario, except for the fact that as officers began approaching, Mr. Morris started to pull away. So the officers flagged him down.
Right. So what case do you have that stopping a moving vehicle is not a seizure? I know you cite that Second Circuit case, Agabaiti. They were plainclothes policemen, so there's no show of authority at all. So what's a case where actual policemen, as in the mind of the driver, flag a car down and that's not a seizure?
Well, Your Honor, we did cite that Second Circuit case. There's another unpublished Second Circuit case, mind you, in a footnote in the brief, where there is a law enforcement official that actually shows his badge to get a taxi driver's attention and the suspect to pull over as a result. Both of those were found to be consensual encounters, because I think it's important, Your Honors, to evaluate this flagging down action in the context of the other facts that we know as officers approached the car, which is they did not block Mr. Morris's exit in any way. There was no brand.
You're not blocked when a patrol car comes up behind you with its sirens on it. I mean, it's not blocking your way on the highway. Let me ask you, I've seen this happen. I may have been victim to it once. Sometimes there are officers outside their patrol cars on the side of the road with a radar gun in their hand. When the radar gun shows someone speeding, they actually point to that car and make a motion to pull over. There's no sirens. They're not in their vehicle. Is that a seizure?
I think, again, Your Honor, it's very fact specific. In that circumstance, you're on a road going, obviously, over the speed limit. And it has all of the defining characteristics of a stop, except for the fact that there's no lights behind you in the rearview mirror. Here, it's moving at a very slow rate of pace through a parking lot, and you have an officer using his hand to get the defendant's attention. And, you know, I think it begs the question, how else do you get a moving motorist attention? The windows could be rolled up. There is a windshield in the way. A verbal request just will not be heard. So I think this flagging down motion is the most sensible way to get a driver's attention.
I agree with that, but it sure sounds like you're stopping someone's movement.
And Your Honor,
And yes, you may have you may have a basis for doing so. But it seems to me, I mean, so you think it turns on the fact that it's a parking lot and he's not going fast?
I think those are characteristics that separate it from a more typical traffic stop, use of sirens or not. And I think a telling sort of hypothetical here is, what if Mr. Morris had been walking from his car to the gas pumps, which is where he said he was going, right? I don't think there'd be much of an issue if they'd come.
Well, I know police can encounter pedestrians, obviously, on the street. You can go up to someone's door and knock and hopefully they'll start talking to you. What case says, though, that if a police are walking down the street and they motion for a pedestrian to, you know, come across the street to my side, do any cases say that's address that and say that's not a seizure? Because to me, that's that this isn't just walking up to a pedestrian. It's telling that pedestrian to stop walking and move to in the officer's direction.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And there are a couple cited in the government's brief, both Fifth Circuit cases, one published, one not, that deal with this in the context of a walking pedestrian or someone standing in a public
place. Well, I've read that case. I think it's the one out of El Paso with the storage unit. I don't see where the police there, you know, motion for him to change where he's going. But anyway, I mean, the ultimate question is, would a reasonable person have felt free to leave? In other words, free to keep driving through the officer holding up his hand?
Yeah.
You're saying a reasonable person would have thought you can blow by those that group of officers and just go on your merry way. I really find that hard to believe. I do.
Yes, Your Honor. And what I want to do is I want to point out just again that they're not exactly blowing through them because they're not blocking his passage. But I do want to talk about, since we're at this point, talk about reasonable suspicion.
Let me ask one last question on this seizure issue, because it's hard reading a dry record, you know, without being in the courtroom and seeing what was the gesture in your view. I mean, I know it's hard to maybe ask you, but you're not the record, but what type of gesture was it that the officers made based on your understanding of the testimony?
My understanding will be no better than the court's, candidly. All I've got is a dry record as well. But I think that we can all be informed by a common sense understanding of what flagging down means, just something akin to what a hitchhiker might do, right? Not a command to stop. There's no indication there was any verbal, you know, stop said by the officers at the time. And then also, you know, the actions that follow, I think, inform what this flagging down motion meant, what it was, which is a consensual encounter until Deputy Motorized, Mr. Morris is sitting in his vehicle and they're just asking him some questions.
But that's kind of, I mean, it's going to make it hard for you now to pivot and say, well, they weren't just waving at him because, in fact, they had suspicion and this was a reasonable suspicion. So I'm going to be discomforted, but you may tell me you can argue both at the same time. If the government can elicit testimony from officers under oath, 1, 2, 3, 4, we didn't have reasonable suspicion. And then on the brief, they describe it as being waved at. But now the alternative argument is, even though the district court didn't reach it, actually they did have reasonable suspicion. Why would we reach that in the first instance, or is at most that argument one we would vacate and remand for?
I think you can reach it in the first instance. And then I want to talk about why the record doesn't prevent that from anything the officer said. But I think this court can reach it in the first instance. I think it's unremarkable for the Fifth Circuit to affirm a motion to suppress on grounds other than what the district court or the magistrate judge found.
But do you have a case where we did that, where the government under oath disclaimed that? And then in the brief to us, they described it oppositely.
Your Honor, I don't think that it's described oppositely or disclaimed. It's argued in the pre-hearing briefing.
Well, Detective Thorpe said, no, I didn't have reasonable suspicion. And then your description was the police waved at a citizen. That doesn't sound like it's a reasonable suspicion detention.
Yes. If you take a step back, I think those comments come on cross-examination about the whether Mr. Deputy Thorpe or any of the other officers suspected criminal activity. I think at first it's important as a legal matter to think of reasonable suspicion as an objective standard, to the extent that the officer's ultimate legal conclusion, those magic words, reasonable suspicion, right, have very little weight in this court's analysis.
I guess I'm just asking you, do you know of a case where a circuit court has said, yes, reasonable suspicion, when the government's argument was, with supporting testimony by police under oath, we didn't have it? Can you think of a case?
No, Your Honor, but again, I want to quibble a little bit with the idea that, that the government's argument was no reasonable suspicion. Again, the pre-hearing briefing discusses reasonable suspicion. If anything, that the focus shifts to consensual encounter at the hearing, perhaps, you're still discussing the circumstances that would give rise to an objective finding of reasonable suspicion. And I also think, Your Honor, in terms of the officer's comments, it's important to, you know, these officers are not legal scholars. When they talk about, I didn't suspect criminal activity, in all likelihood, they're talking about, I didn't feel comfortable arresting the man at that point because I didn't know for sure if he was doing anything wrong. You have one of the officers, Your Honor, talk about how he had a hunch. Now, that word has significance in the Court of Appeals, right? And in the law, as a hunch being insufficient. But to this individual, suspicion is a hunch, is thinking something might be awry. I think it's dangerous to put too much weight on these comments from officers when the video camera, the body camera shows, obviously they're approaching Mr. Morris because they think something is amiss at his vehicle.
Counsel, does the hunch have to be articulable?
Articulable suspicion? Yes, Your Honor. And I think you have that in this case. And I want to discuss why now.
What was the articulated hunch?
The articulable suspicion here.
Was it based on evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. There are really three things that officers know before, and they all work together, before they even make contact with Mr. Morris, before the flagging down motion occurs. And it's very similar to Flowers in this instance. You've got Mr. Morris parked in a unusual place in the parking lot. And the deputies, to a man, testify that we don't see passenger cars back there. There's a place in the parking lot where passenger cars park. We don't see them back behind the trucks and are with the trucks. And again, this is described as a very high crime parking lot. It's a defined bounds, similar to the area in Flowers, that's so high crime, drug activity is mentioned multiple times, that it warrants a designated foot patrol nightly.
My reading of it is they exhausted all the reasons they might have had a suspicion. They might have been entering trucks or something like that. But after they talked to him for a while and got a clear license plate, nothing else, I don't see how the suspicion, if there was one, had lasted that long.
Yes, Your Honor. I think the suspicion only heightens as they make contact with Mr. Morris. Again, if the court's concerned about a potential seizure point being the flagging down, then we will not consider the comments made after that. But when they speak with Mr. Morris, if anything, the suspicion heightens, right? He gives a travel description that is entirely consistent with courier activity. He gives a very inconsistent explanation for what he was up to. You know, he says, I'm getting some rest, I'm sleeping, but also his running lights are on, the vehicle's running, according to one deputy. And he begins to pull away as officers approach, obviously. And then he says, I was just headed over to the gas pumps, trying to get some sleep, but also I'm not going anywhere. I'm just headed over to the gas pumps. So these explanations are dissonant and really don't stack up. So the suspicion heightens once they make contact with Mr. Morris. I think that's pretty plain. And the question becomes whether there's reasonable, if the flagging down is a seizure, whether they had reasonable suspicion before that point. And the car driving away, its running lights being on, the car running itself at 2 a.m. among the 18-wheelers cuts against the idea that he's back there innocently sleeping before officers even make contact with him. And of course, a passenger car among all these 18-wheelers stands out like a sore thumb. You know, is this a drug dealer back there conducting business with the 18-wheelers? Or not drug conduct, Your Honors, but I know it's just common sense. You see a single passenger car among all these 18-wheelers, you think it might be some sort of sex trafficking or prostitution going on. And that's not something the officers point to, but I think it's a common sense inference. So, back to the notion that some of these officers say, well, I didn't suspect criminal activity. One, they're not legal scholars. And two, it is ultimately an objective standing. If they said, I absolutely suspected criminal activity, I was certain there was reasonable suspicion, of course, this court would not take them at their word on that. There would still need to be an objective finding by the court, by the district court, or this court in the first instance, given this court's ability to do that, to affirm on any basis supported by the record. I want to move now, Your Honors, to talk about this stop as we get to the discussion with Deputy Mott. This is the portion that is recorded. Again, none of this initial interaction with Deputy Thorpe and Deputy Fontenot is recorded. So I want to talk specifically about this consent issue, consent to search, and whether the district court committed clear error in its analysis that this was a voluntarily given consent to search.
Before you get there, you're not, therefore, just so I understand this, the continuum and where you do or don't ever think he was detained, when the officers do use the expression, "we'll let you go," are you acknowledging he was detained at that point at least?
Or is, no, your position, Honor.
Is your position still both? He wasn't detained, they didn't have to have his position, but they did have reasonable suspicion.
Yes, Your Honor. My position is at no point was Mr. Morris detained. And I'll tell you, those comments, right, they're really just an artful way of phrasing a common sentiment in police interviews, right? I got some
questions. But it might be, I mean, again, it's sort of like Judge Costa was saying, I do wave at police, they drive by, they wave back. I know that's just a wave. But when they're just as his example, they point to me pulling over. So if a policeman says, well, we want to talk to you, you're going to help yourself out, and if you do, we'll let you go, a reasonable person would think, okay, right now I can't go. How could that not be what the person would be thinking? If they use the expression, we'll let you go, what's the case that says that doesn't mean exactly what it says?
There's no, Your Honor, I don't have a case to give you that says that's not.
No, but we do need some cases either for flag down, moving vehicle, isn't a stop, or telling someone, if you do the following, we'll let you go. That's actually not being not let go. We need cases for some of these propositions.
Yes, Your Honor. We cited a Fifth Circuit case regarding an officer telling a suspect in a police interview that don't leave now, I'm going to get something, I'll be back. And you know that was not found to be a detention. And I think, again, what you've got here is a sentiment that comes up in many interactions, and that is, I've got some questions. The sooner you clear this up, the sooner you can go about your way, the sooner we'll be done with you, phrased inartfully, but it does not justify reversal under the clear error standard again, right? Multiple reasonable interpretations of the significance of a piece of evidence precludes reversal on appeal under that deferential clear error standard, because this is a factual finding, not a legal one. The circumstances surrounding this stop beyond that, none of them suggest undue coercion. The officers don't brandish any firearms at any point. They don't restrain Mr. Morris physically, anything like that. And although they ask for consent multiple times, that's in the context of what's going on here, which is they're unable to get a clear answer from Mr. Morris. So I think that officers, they're entitled to seek that definitive answer one way or another, under these circumstances. And, you know, this court would not want an officer interpreting ambiguously a consent to search. And so, you know, for that reason, these follow-up attempts are not coercive. They're just an effort to get an answer. The only question of legal significance, correct, is whether you will consent to a search of your vehicle or not. And Mr. Morris is being ambiguous and cagey throughout this entire exchange, gesturing to the vehicle, inviting officers to search.
What about
him.
The comment? There's a comment I've seen in the video where the officer suggests, you know, you've got nothing to hide. If you're innocent, let me search. And I thought we have case law saying that can be a coercive tactic.
Your Honor, the cases that I'm aware of regarding that, and these kind of lead into Judge Higginson's question as well about these sort of comments that sort of forcefully explain the benefit of cooperation. We cited a case in the brief, Williams, where an officer approached an individual at a public terminal, airport, bus stop, something to that effect, and said, you know, you mind if I search your person? The guy said, you know, well, you know, I don't know. And he said, well, if you don't have any drugs on you, you got nothing to hide. And that was not found to render the stop coercive. There's another case, Your Honor, if I can find the citation here.
Before you do, because your time's running out, let's say you are persuasive on any of the multiple theories, and we do get to the sentencing. Would you agree with, it doesn't really present the counterfactual one that the AUSA, do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. There are individuals identified. Their names may not be given, but there, you know, there is the, as Your Honor
mentioned. The district court never looked at them. The district court went off on this, we just can't identify. but the defendant had actually identified the two he wanted to be compared to. And then it looked like the assistant U.S. attorney responding to the PSR objection said, well, no, couriers are always essential. And then at sentencing, the government says, oops, that was wrong. Now, but we've got a case that no one knows what to do. Would we at best have to vacate remand so there can be the comparison to the two people Morris wanted to be compared to?
No, Your Honor, and a couple of reasons why. One is the principle cited in our brief that this sort of explicit analysis is not required as long as the record provides a basis for denial of that minor participant reduction. And here it does, but there were factual findings made, Your Honor, specifically when defense counsel suggested that Mr. Morris did not understand the scope and structure of this scheme. The district court very pointedly said, do we not think he did not understand the scope and structure? He has signed up for, and the only individual identified that has signed up for, a transnational scheme, right? Mr. Morris, by definition of his conduct, knows he's carrying drugs from the border to the East Coast. The other individuals identified, Your Honor, and I'm sort of winning my own argument at this point, the district court does not get this explicit, to be clear. The other individual identified, we have no basis to say that they similarly understood the scope and structure. So at best, I don't see how you ever get to a point where Mr. Morris can be found to be substantially less culpable than those two individuals. It seems like a remand would be improper and a waste of time, Your Honor, to be candid. And with that, I want to thank the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Yes, sir. I really have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I would just point out a couple of things regarding inconsistent statements. Corporal Matt agreed that none of the answers that Mr. Moore gave were inconsistent. That's at record page 158. And I wanted to also note that the district court's finding that this was a consensual encounter was a finding that went only to the waving of the car down. The court never addressed whether it continued to be a consensual stop, even though that is what counsel argued in his motion, and even though counsel argued that in the objections. So there's never been a finding whether all that activity, taking him out of the car and all that, converted the stop into one that was one in which Mr. Morris was not free to leave.
Did the government originally have alternative arguments? This, we had reasonable suspicion, and then it just sort of went one route and no one ever came back and tied the loop in the alternative? Is that what happened?
The government did make an argument in its motion, in its response to the motion, that there was reasonable suspicion based on the fact that the car was parked a certain way. They added another thing that says,
But then whatever happened with that? No one ever, the witnesses disclaimed it, and then it wasn't raised in any type of closing argument, and the district court just went, is that essentially what happened? It became a loose strand?
Right. Well, I think it's near the end, after the evidence was adduced at the hearing, the AUSA did make a comment about there being reasonable suspicion. The argument, as I recall, was based on the fact that only a person who had something to hide would give answers that were not suspicious to the questions by the police. That was the argument. I know that you couldn't sell the court on that argument, but as I recall, that was about the limit of their argument.
Okay, thank you.
And I was just thinking about Attic Bite. I know it's a Second Circuit case, but it just dawned on me that it was an ice cream truck, and even a small child could wave down an ice cream truck. I know that I used to. But unless the court has any other questions, I will conclude.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. In case I'll be submitted, we'll call the next case to be argued today.